Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome one and all to Trisha's True Crime Radio. Now, we are the only radio show that makes you want to tap your toes, whistle while you work, do the Harlem Shake, and solve crime all at the same time. Trisha's True Crime Radio is brought to you by your local no-kill animal shelter. Go to www.nokillnetwork.org and find your local no-kill shelter. You could do something as easy as volunteering an hour a week to help out. It doesn't need to be money. They will accept anything that you might have to offer. That is your local no-kill network at nokillnetwork.org. Tonight we have the wonderful and incredible Wendy Murphy with us, and we're going to talk about everything and pretty much solve the world's problems. But first, they were found 34 years apart, but they are so similar, and it's so shocking. I'm talking about the boy in the box found in 1957 and Baby Hope, the girl in the cooler, found in 1991. In 1957, a Caucasian boy believed to be between 4 and 6 years old was found on a Susquehanna Road in the northeastern part of Philly. He was found lying face up in a cardboard box. It was an old beat-up cardboard box. There were bruises all over his body, and they appeared to be inflicted at the same time, so he was beaten, basically. Now, back then, they didn't have all the cool computer software that we have now, so they had to do something pretty gruesome. They literally cleaned up this young boy, put him in some clothes, sat him in a chair, and took pictures of him. Pictures they later passed out to the media, but to no avail. No one has stepped forward to tell us who this young boy was. He had scarring from some sort of major surgery. It was pretty big. He had a haircut. He was malnourished. But it just seems like there's enough clues there that his identity would have been found out. Someone would have come forward. But still, it sits unsolved in Philadelphia. Fast forward to 1991. A young female child, ages 3 to 5 years old, was found in an upside-down igloo cooler. You've seen them. It was in the wooded area of Henry Hudson Parkway in Manhattan. Now, this is awful. She was horribly sexually abused and starved. Despite law enforcement's best efforts to identify her, she is still unclaimed and an open case file. The NYPD decided to give another big push to find the killer and identity of Baby Hope just last week. So far, nothing. The boy in the box, Baby Hope, the girl in the cooler. How can these two kids be so brutally murdered and not even be reported missing, let alone identified when we find them? It's too awful to comprehend. But here's what I'd like you to do sometime soon, tonight if possible. I'd like you to go look at these two cases yourself. Go to americasunknownchild.net. That's America's, plural, unknownchild.net for all the clues to the boy in the box. And go to websleuths.com/forums, and you'll see at the top of the page a link to the Baby Hope case. We've got to do something, and maybe, just maybe, this is our week that those two cases will at least, we'll find out who those children were, because they deserve at least that much. Wendy Murphy, author of And Justice for Some. Be sure and check out our website at wendymurphylaw.com. Wendy, welcome. You have a tad bit of a cold / allergy. Don't worry.
I apologize in advance. I'm going to sneeze, I'm sure.
We will. We'll take you any way we can, okay? Sick, non-sick, whatever works, we'll take you. You know, for some strange reason, I want to start off with Jodi Arias. It's, again, my personal freak show, the way that trial was run and how they were allowed to trash Travis so much. But I guess I miss the agitation and anger I used to feel when the discussion would come up. Now, what is the latest attempt in the new punishment phase for Arias? What's going on there, Wendy?
Well, the last that I've heard, and, you know, it has been such a busy week, actually the past couple of weeks, with Zimmerman and the Bulger trial in Massachusetts, and then we had an NFL player here charged with murder, and then there was a horrific murder of a young woman in South Boston, which is ordinarily a very safe area, just brazenly kidnapped in her own car and brutally attacked by a guy with a very long rap sheet who had a habit of picking on women. And this was just his latest victim. And it's been so busy I'm answering your question long-winded because I hope I'm up to speed, and if I'm not, I apologize to your listeners. But I think the last I heard is that the Arias trial won't start until the fall, and it will be a trial only on the question of the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And even at that, it won't be a retrial of the question, was the murder extremely cruel? Because all of those things have been decided, that she's mm-hmm. eligible, that she was extremely cruel. And now, you know, the jury just has to figure out whether on balance, in light of possible mitigation factors and so forth, should her life be spared or should they vote for death? And if it's not a unanimous decision, then her life is automatically spared. Now, what's interesting is that we know the jury selection will be long, arduous, and very important, because really the question is going to be, can the people who sit in judgment get over whatever profound feelings they may have about either what mm-hmm. she looks like or what she did, and did she have a problem in her childhood? You know, if you're going to vote for death, you have to do it with logic and sound reason, and you have to do it with a fair application of the law. And, you know, for some people who looked at Jodi Arias, and I think especially the guys who looked at Jodi Arias as she was describing one form of sex after the next, and I bent over and I was, you know, the oral mm-hmm. and anal, I mean, as soon as she started talking like a porn star, virtually all of the guys on the panel, I think, were never going to vote for death, even mm-hmm. if they couldn't help but vote for guilt and find that it was extremely atrocious and so forth. They nevertheless, I think, were going to be hard-pressed to vote for guilt, because if you are a juror looking at the face of a woman who's good-looking and she's talking about sex, a red-blooded guy can't help but feel some kind of erotic urge. I'm not saying they all wanted to sleep with her, but you can't help but feel erotic stimulation when
I got to stop you. I mean, do you really think that every single man can't control that emotion enough to...
It's not that they can't control it. Let me explain. It's not that they can't control it. That's such a good question. And no, and I'm not suggesting these guys are a bunch of idiots, although some guys are idiots. I'm saying mm-hmm. that when you're in an emotional moment in the middle of an intense trial and your feelings are the most important thing, and you're on the one hand very angry, and you are so angry that this woman has slaughtered this poor guy with all the stab wounds and the slit from ear to ear, and it could not have been more cold and brutal, and she's clearly a psychopath, if you ask me, mm-hmm. and ask most people. But you get those kinds of feelings and then put them in the same room as anal and oral sex with a pretty good-looking woman who's describing it in detail on a sex tape. The man's brain gets confused. And when you ask the brain to separate out what are just basic human urges, and I'm not mm-hmm. saying an urge about Jodi Arias, I'm saying it is necessarily an erotic feeling, and you mix that together with a very somber and serious decision-making process about whether a person has committed brutal murder and should be put to death, it's very difficult, because that sexual fog, you know, she says she was in a fog during all the stabbings. I say there was a lot of fog in that room, and I called it the sex fog on the air for a reason. It is very difficult for even the best people who want to do the right thing to rise above their internal confusion, their internal, what I want to say, can best be described as a kind of, you know, earthquake of very intense emotions. And mm-hmm. they don't even know about it. The guys who voted to spare her life, and my sense is that it was mostly guys. I don't know 100%, but my sense is it was almost all guys. There may have been one female, but it was mostly the guys, which is why the defense was so happy to choose guys to be on the jury to begin with. But it was mostly the guys, and it's not their fault. It's like asking a human being whether they have a bias in favor of Italians, and they are Italian. They don't think they're biased. but it's in mm-hmm. them, you know? And we can't help but have those biases and those feelings in us, and you can't expect good, decent people to be self-aware and objective about their own very deep, very normal, natural human feelings. They get confused. They think they're being logical, but they can't help but be victims of their own internal emotions. I don't want to call them flaws. I don't even want to call them flaws because I don't want to criticize the guys. But it is mm-hmm. absolutely, in my opinion, a weakness in the human condition, predominantly a male weakness that the defense exploited. They knew exactly what they were doing, and they predicted well. They got mostly men to vote to save her life. And the reason I'm saying all this, Tricia, is the next time a jury is selected, you can bet the prosecution is going to try very hard not to pick those kinds of jurors. And I don't just mean not men, but those kinds of men who voted to spare her life.
Let me ask you this. What do you base this on? I mean, it sounds... I understand what you're saying, but is there any sort of scientific knowledge or anything to back this up?
Well, of course there is. I mean, I've been a prosecutor. I've selected juries. I've selected juries in cases where I was concerned about the biases that would be inherent in the human condition, not biases like, oh, that guy's mother is a cop or that woman's father went to jail. Not those kinds of, in my opinion, fairly superficial biases, but the deeply embedded stuff that comes from who we are based on these very basic urges, and whether it's an exploitation of racism. And by the way, jury selection experts are very good at what they do because they know the science, and they could tell it to you by citing research faster than I can, but mm-hmm. I've been in the room when those types of people, the jury selection experts, are trying to explain to me as a prosecutor what kind of jury might be good or bad for us. Just think about the O.J. Simpson case. The evidence against Simpson was overwhelming, but the emotional reaction of predominantly black jurors was so strong that they couldn't even take in the information objectively, because the information goes in to a body and a brain, a human being, who is so affected by the overarching, largely false narrative about racism in the O.J. Simpson case, they can't take in the information correctly, much less assess it correctly. Mm-hmm. And the defense in that case knew that emotion, in that very deep sense, really is an extremely advantageous feature of the jury system in this country in terms of what defense attorneys try to exploit. They might not like to admit it out loud, but exploiting those deep feelings that human beings have, whether it's sex or race or, something else, mm-hmm. exploitation of those very deep feelings is absolutely part of the game and doesn't always work. You know, for, mm-hmm. for the Scott Peterson case, for example, as you may remember, there were a lot of very strong feelings in that case, because you look at a guy like Scott Peterson and you desperately want to believe that a handsome dream date Ken kind of guy who is married and about to have his firstborn son would never, ever kill his wife, much less his nearly born child,
mm-hmm.
because that's not what those kinds of guys do. I've seen men like that. That's not what they do. They're nice. They're happy. They're excited to become a father. They're good people. Well, when you exploit the fear that people have, which comes with the willingness, with reluctance, I should say, to accept the idea that a handsome man like Scott Peterson could be a dastardly killer, it's so difficult to get the brain to go from here to there that just what he looked like and what his life seemed to be was that same kind of internal gut feeling that makes it hard for jurors to see the truth and accept the truth. Now, the difference is, of course, once Scott Peterson became the cheating spouse
mm-hmm.
with the blonde chicky girlfriend, once he became the monster who was on the phone with his girlfriend at his then missing, we didn't yet know, dead wife's vigil, that's
mm-hmm.
it. Then they're, we don't want to believe this handsome man could be guilty, turned over into, we can't wait to you know, burn him at the stake.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, it's the same emotion, it's the other side of the coin. So, Tricia, the point is, and I think your listeners already know this anyway, defense attorneys have a lot more flexibility, especially compared to the prosecution, to just explicitly manipulate anything they want in the name of winning. They can manipulate racism, they can exploit social prejudice that is religious or based on gender, they can exploit sex. You know, the whole reason Arias was allowed to testify for 3 weeks about nonsense,
mm-hmm.
that was ridiculous and irrelevant nonsense, was not only, I think, embarrassing to our legal system, but I thought it was just shameless that the defense saw fit to put on such a dog and pony show, but really it was the judge's call to stop it, and the judge didn't. And sometimes, just because it's a death penalty case, the judge lets the lawyers act like monkeys, and, you know, the witnesses can just lie through their teeth and make stuff up, and the experts get to testify that up is down and black is white. In other words, the rules just don't matter when it's a death penalty case. But that doesn't sit right with me. Just because it's a death penalty case, when I read the rules of evidence, they're the same. They're the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like the rules of evidence work fairly and well if it's a drunk driving case, and then they don't work at all if you brutally murder someone. No. The rules of evidence are the rules of evidence. And it takes a good judge with a thick skin and a strong mind and a commitment to the room and to the integrity of what it means to have a fair legal system. That judge has a job to do, to keep lawyers in line so that they don't do what Jody Arias did. That judge
mm-hmm.
was out of her mind, in my opinion, for letting Arias go on and on the way she did with all that sex talk. You know, Tricia, or you may know, I haven't been on your show since, but the last around the last time I was on your show was when the trial was still ongoing, and
mm-hmm.
I was so angry watching Arias lie on the stand and exploit her sexuality with her. You know, she wore the tighter shirt and she had her hair all flowy and sexy when she was testifying about the sex stuff. By the time it got around to the death penalty hearing, she was wearing baggy clothes and she had her bangs all greasy in front of her forehead and she looked like a mental patient. I mean,
yeah.
that was not an accident. That was part of the plan, that at some point they want her to look like a porn star, and then when it got to the stage of, oh, my God, they might put her to death, we want her to look a little mentally ill, there'll be even more compassion for her. I was so offended by what our legal system allowed her to do in terms of manipulation that I said on Jane Velez's show, when she asked me, what do you think of where we are now? The defense experts are about to take the stand. Jody just got off the stand, you know, for 18 days. What do
mm-hmm.
you think, Wendy? And I said, I think we just heard 3 weeks of absolute nonsense, and now we're about to hear 2 weeks from her experts, 2 weeks of absolute bullshit.
I love my favorite moment of Jane Velez Mitchell.
Well, you know, but you know what happened? I got kicked off the air, though. You know, I got punished, and I'm thinking to
you
myself,
did?
Of course I did. I was off the air for at least a week,
right.
Maybe more. That's okay. You know what? I knew it was wrong in all my years on TV, 20 years on TV. I've never said it because I
mm-hmm.
knew it was wrong, but it needed to be said because, Tricia, my point was, if I have to live in a country where somebody who sliced a guy's head off and was allowed to not only lie about it, but stoke all the guys in the jury with her sex talk and act like
mm-hmm.
a porn queen to get, not for any reason except to get the guys so confused in their boxer shorts that they couldn't think straight about the evidence. If
mm-hmm.
I have to live in a country where that's considered legal, which to me should have been censored, if they couldn't stop her from doing it, they should have at least censored her. And to me, if she didn't have to be censored, why shouldn't I be allowed to say the word bullshit?
Well, that's, I can't get an argument from me there. I just want to give you a couple of things that people are saying in the chat room. And Wendy,
uh-huh.
I know you've faced these questions before and you're not afraid to face them. One of our members, Sleuth 50, said, poor hapless characters. My goodness, I wonder how many terrible decisions I've made so far owing to my lack of ability to control my sexual impulses.
No, that's not what I said. That is not
okay.
what I said.
Right. I know. That's
what
I'm...
We are all human. We come to the process with our human
right.
frailties. When I hear a case about child abuse, I have an mm-hmm. extra urge because I have children. You know, I have
right.
I have my own baggage that informs how I react. And I'm just saying, mm-hmm. porn, explicit sex talk, absolutely affects especially heterosexual men. It just does. Now, that doesn't mean the guys are saying to themselves, oh, boy, I think I'll vote not guilty because I'd like to have sex with her. But mm-hmm. at a very basic level, it affects men differently, and the defense knows it.
Mm-hmm.
It knows it. It's why racism was exploited. Do you think any of the black jurors in the O.J. Simpson case thought to themselves, here I am being black, so I think I'll be unfair? I think I'll be
right.
overly fair to O.J. because we're both black? No, they don't think they're being anything. They think they're being fair.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that guys are stupid. It's not that they can't think straight. It's that the emotion that's inside of us is affected by the drama in the courtroom, and defense attorneys in particular are allowed to exploit it. The prosecution can't. The prosecution can get in very bad trouble if they exploit emotion. They can get in super bad trouble if they engage in anything remotely racist or sexist or offensive to people based on religion and ethnicity. The defense can be racist. We live in a country where the defense is allowed to be racist
mm-hmm.
in the name of justice, not the prosecution. And I really, you know, I really feel strongly about this. I've written about this in my book, and Justice for Some, I have a whole chapter on this, that if we really care about fairness in our legal system, we need to be yelling and screaming and throwing things when defense
mm-hmm.
attorneys exploit things like racism and sex just to win, just for tactical value. If it's not relevant, it shouldn't be allowed. It was not relevant that Jodi Arias danced around her bed or whatever she did in the months
right.
before. Not relevant. It is not relevant. Half of the racism stuff that came out in OJ, not half, 99.9% of the racist nonsense that came out, irrelevant. And
mm-hmm.
if you want to live in a country with fair verdicts, that is fair to people, you can't let some of the lawyers in some of the cases exploit social prejudice to win and
mm-hmm.
then expect the rest of us to think that prejudice is bad. It's not. If you allow it to have value in a legal system, you can't then complain about it. When people
right.
when people say, well, wait a minute now, I see racism. Well, yeah, the judge just gave it a party in courtroom
mm-hmm.
12.
I hear you. Well, basically, when we're talking with Wendy Murphy, and Wendy, after listening to you talk, it just seems like the trial is over after the jury's picked almost. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, in some cases. Not in all cases, but there are
mm-hmm.
some cases where, because remember, the defense in Jodi Arias was never planning to win the case. That was never, ever, ever part of their strategy. Their only strategy was to spare her life with a couple of votes against death, and that was their whole purpose in everything that they did, including how they tried the case. The trial itself was really all about saving her life, and so, you know, sometimes no matter how much you pound the pavement and scream and yell and throw things around the courtroom, you still can't win. But there are cases, and Jodi Arias is one of them, where who gets sat as a juror is determinative, in my opinion, of whether you're likely to get the result that you want from a prosecutorial perspective. And I saw that jury, when I saw all the guys on the jury in Arias, day one, I mean, this was before the sex talk, but day one,
mm-hmm.
I said, that's weird. That is really weird. Why would the defense let so many men sit on this jury? That is inconsistent with a general approach to what genders do you want on this kind of jury. Once
mm-hmm.
they started with the sex talk, then it made sense to me, perfect sense
knew.
To me. Yep.
Here's a question. How will the process draw a line between recapping the guilt phase and introduction of new evidence into the Jodi Arias trial? They can't introduce anything new, and they're just going to be very strict about it, right?
Well, no. I disagree that they can't introduce anything new. They can with regard to mitigation and so forth, and no judge would stop them. But here's what's interesting. Remember that the jury in the first case was both the guilt jury and the punishment jury. This time,
mm-hmm.
that the jury that sat won't hear any of the guilt stuff. and why that could be good for the state. In fact, the state may well have anticipated this very result, but why that might be good for the state is no matter how many guys are seated, and I guarantee you the defense will try to sit lots of guys for the same reason, we're going to see a lot of the same strategies. But why it's a little bit better for the state this time around is no way is the judge going to let 18 days worth of testimony that's
right.
all with the sex talk and all that. That's not going to come out. And so the room will be, how shall I put it, a lot less hot. The room will be a lot less hot. Some of the sex talk will come out, and I guarantee you the defense will cherry pick the most erotic things they can get their hands on, and they will put it on. They'll play the tapes. They'll do everything they can to sex up the room. The judge isn't going to give them 18 days and all the expert testimony. That's not going to happen. We're not going to hear from the two hired guns that the defense had up there. But it will be a very sex-heavy, there's no question, a very sex-heavy hearing.
Mm-hmm.
It just won't go on for as long, and I don't believe that we will have Jodi Arias on for 18 days. We may see her up there. We may see her up there. She's a very good performer. You know, most sociopaths are good performers.
Yes.
So she may well take the stand, and I wouldn't be surprised if she took the stand, but it won't be 18 days and it won't be all sex all the time. I also think we should be careful, you know, to be skeptical, I should say, when the defense once again does not call her mother to the stand or her friend. And believe
right.
me, it won't be because the mother's worried they might cross-examine her about some ugly thing from her past. That's nonsense. No mother ever gets cross-examined about those things. And it won't be because the friend's worried about talk about drugs. No. The reason the defense is not going to put on those mitigation witnesses, so the most I think we'll see is Jodi on the stand and then a replay of the first sentencing hearing. But why we won't is because the Ninth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals, which is in California, but it covers Arizona in terms of the federal jurisdiction. And remember, even though this is a state prosecution, a state murder trial, after the appeals within the state court system are done, and her conviction will absolutely be affirmed, and if they vote for death, it will absolutely be upheld in Arizona by the Arizona Supreme Court, then she has a chance to go into federal court. And in the federal court system, she has to start in the Arizona federal court, and then when she appeals from them, she'll land before the Ninth Circuit Appellate Court in California. That's the federal appellate court in California that covers Arizona. That court has a 15-year history and a track record they're proud of reversing death penalty decisions on the grounds that the defense fail to call mitigation witnesses during the death penalty phase. That is ineffective assistance of counsel. We hereby vacate the death penalty. And and your audience is going to be the first to know this, not only do they have a long track record of doing that, there are actually lots of prosecutors out there, and there's been law review articles written about this. How do we stop this? These are defense attorneys who are intentionally violating their code of ethics by not calling mitigation witnesses such as the mother and the friend in any kind of trial like this. And then when they get to the Ninth Circuit, some other lawyer gets hired. So, you know, Jodi's current lawyers will be gone. They'll hire some other lawyers who will say her lawyers at the time of the sentencing hearing were ineffective because the mother was sitting right there and they didn't put her on the stand, and that was ineffective because she could have told the jury how Jodi was such a lovely child and so forth and so on, and that was unconstitutional, violation of Jodi's rights. You have to reverse the death penalty. And the Ninth Circuit, in, I want to say, 14 cases over the past 10 to 15 years, 14 cases on that basis alone has reversed the death penalty conviction in lots of states coming from Arizona and other states, all in the Ninth Circuit. 14 reversals just because the lawyer didn't call mitigation witnesses and the federal appellate attorney argued that that decision was ineffective assistance of counsel.
And so they do this on purpose. Defense attorneys do this
exactly.
on purpose.
Yep.
They don't defend her to the best of their ability and do everything they can in their power. They intentionally do a few mistakes here and there, and boom, they know the Ninth Circuit is going to overturn it.
Well, this one in particular. Yeah, but this particular error, they don't just do a lot of bad stuff. They do this one thing. They intentionally do not call mitigation witnesses. Intentionally.
Right.
Because the Ninth Circuit has said, if no mitigation witnesses are called, we will reverse the death penalty on the grounds that the lawyer was ineffective. So, you know, judges, in my opinion, should be saying, I'm going to call mitigation witnesses myself. You know, I think judges should be putting a stop to this. And hopefully, if somebody knows that this is a trick, and the prosecution, I'm sure, has a sense of it, they should call the mitigation witnesses. The prosecutor should call the mitigation witnesses. It's a little weird, but, you know, it's one of those things where you have to wonder, is it worth it to get the death penalty today when you know it's going to get reversed down the line? But is it a little weird for the prosecutor to call the Jodi Arias' mother to the stand to ask if she was a nice kid? I mean, that the public would freak out. But it's almost the only way to stop it.
I was going to say, that's, you know, I don't think from what we've seen of the prosecutor, he's quite the pit bull. I think he would do what had to be done. And wouldn't that be surprising if he did?
I wish Juan Martinez would call
Jodi Arias'
mother. He's a good lawyer.
Mother.
He's a smart lawyer, and he has every reason to be angry, and I think he's appropriate about his, you know, his handling of the case. I have to say, there were times when I thought his technical skills were lacking, and, you know, he doesn't always seem as tight with the evidence as he could be, but he knows that case inside and out. He's appropriately angry. I'm sure it's making him crazy that he had to watch Jodi Arias testify about sex the way she did. I think that probably made his brain explode. But the judge let it happen, and there's only so much you can do. So I think he will, you know, he'll do what he has to do. He's a grown-up. If the judge allows this craziness to happen where the defense doesn't put on the mother as a mitigation expert, as a mitigation witness, you know, Martinez knows that a few years down the line, that means the death penalty verdict will be overturned, but at least it'll be on the table for a while. That could be how he's thinking about this issue. To me, it's crazy. To me, it's wrong that a defense attorney could be unethical as a strategy. It's just so wrong. It is so wrong. It's like being racist as a strategy.
Right.
I'm telling you, the fact that our legal system tolerates this stuff is why people don't respect our legal system.
But how do you prove it? That's the thing. We're talking with Wendy Murphy. We're talking about the Jodi Arias trial and the upcoming penalty phase. And Wendy Murphy is. And Michael is here. Michael is here. Hi, Michael. Michael is my co-host, Wendy. And Michael is the one that always asks all the good questions that I forget. So he's the one that knows how to come up with the good ones. Michael, I'm just recapping for everybody. We're talking about the Jodi Arias trial and the penalty phase. And Wendy Murphy is saying that she believes the defense will not call the right mitigating witnesses, Jodi's mother, Jodi's father, to talk about what a great woman she was and a great child. And then when it goes through the appeals and gets to the Ninth Circuit, all of a sudden the Ninth Circuit goes, hey, no mitigating witnesses, it's overturned. Now, when that happens, you can continue to fight it, right, Wendy? The prosecution or the Arizona can continue on up the chain, correct?
Well, what happens is if the Ninth Circuit reverses on the grounds of ineffective assistance of counsel because Jodi's lawyers refused to call mitigation witnesses to testify about reasons to spare Jodi's life. If the Ninth Circuit says that was ineffective assistance of counsel, the prosecution has the option of then filing with the United States Supreme Court. They have to file what's called a petition for certiorari. But the Supreme Court of the United States may or may not grant review, and they might just say, you know, this isn't an important enough case to us, we're not going to review it, at which point the case gets remanded to the Arizona state court system where there has to be, that's right, another penalty hearing.
Oh, can you imagine? Michael, go ahead. Yes, Michael. Believe me,
Wendy,
you're going
to
love Michael.
Hi, Michael.
Yeah. Hi, thank you. Sorry, first of all, Tricia, that I was so late. I was on
That's
the phone,
okay.
as I told you in a text. But Wendy, when they initially, Judge Stevens had, for just that short period of time, allowed the release of in-chambers and at-bench conferences, it was brought up that Martinez, with Patty Womack, for example, was going to explore her drug use, her not filing the correct papers with welfare for receiving money for videos and pictures of Jody claiming income. And we also know from in chambers that there were other discussions pertaining to other mitigating witnesses that the defense had planned on calling, where Juan was perfectly willing for them to be called and had ammunition on all of them. For example, the interrogation tapes of the mother could have then come in where she was saying there's something
true.
Wrong with
that's
Jody.
That's not true.
Well, I know for a fact
Not true. Let me tell you
this. It's true about Patty and...
No, but listen. Don't misstate things, because here's what you need to know. There is an argument about everyone that if they testify in mitigation, you know, they're going to get cross-examined in ways that are terrible, blah, blah, blah. The reality is prosecutors don't tend to cross-examine parents during mitigation. Find me an example. They don't do it. Number one, it's disrespectful. Number two, it's not necessary. Number three, it rubs the jury the wrong way. If a mother is sobbing and saying, please spare my daughter's life, no prosecutor worth their salt is going to say, and let me tell you how much your daughter is an asshole. It's not going to happen. So I don't accept that those are the reasons why he's not calling mitigation witnesses. Moreover, if you can't call the mother because she's a mental case and you can't call the friend because she's a drug dealer, you can find someone somewhere to get up there and say, I knew her in school. Call one of the high school teachers who says she was such a great artist and said she was lovely. You can call 100 people to say, when I knew her, she was nice.
They had 5 years, Wendy, to find someone, and they couldn't. They had
Daryl Fuller
right across
the street. That's a lie. That's a lie. That's a lie.
Michael, everybody be nice. Be nice, be nice. Hold on.
It's a lie that there's not a single person that knows her from her childhood that could say something nice about her that doesn't have such baggage that they can't handle cross-examination. That's not possible.
Well, then why didn't they suss them out? If they had 5 years to find them.
Because obviously you didn't hear me. What I'm saying is the reason they're not calling mitigation witnesses is strategic, because the Ninth Circuit has a demonstrated pattern of reversing death penalty judgments in cases where the defense intentionally doesn't put on any mitigation witnesses. They call it ineffective assistance of counsel. Therefore, the death penalty verdict is overturned. The Ninth Circuit doesn't like the death penalty. That may not surprise you. It's the most liberal circuit in the country. They don't like the death penalty. They find ways to overturn it. This is one of their favorites. So lawyers who
know
the strategy will intentionally play to it.
And I understand what you're saying, and that's appalling. Wendy, I have a question. So if when the Supreme Court or the Ninth Circuit or whoever gets this case, are they given the in-chambers and at-bench conference minutes as part of – do they get everything so they can see what was said in chambers?
Yes, and you can bet Martinez is saying, listen, I want it on the record. I think this is strategic, and I want it on the record that they're doing this on purpose. And if they don't call mitigation witnesses, you know, I don't want to hear about it when the Ninth Circuit gets it. But there are so many Ninth Circuit cases now decided that give defense attorneys a beautiful pathway. There's law review articles written about this. Any defense attorney who wants to get their case overturned on appeal at the Ninth Circuit has to do it this way, that way, and the other way, and they're guaranteed, virtually guaranteed, a reversal of the conviction, of the judgment of death by the time it gets to the Ninth Circuit. The whole game is it's a big chess game. The plan is laid.
It's terrible.
And you know what? One of the best law review articles on this topic makes the argument that lawyers who do it should be referred to the licensing board.
Bar.
That judges
Absolutely.
Who see it. But in response to that, lawyers like the lawyers that Jodi Arias has, if this is her tactic and they know it's unethical, they're doing other things to make it seem like it's not unethical, right? So they're going to pad the record with seemingly legitimate claims like, we couldn't find anybody. That's what
exactly.
they're going to do to, you know what I mean? It's all a chess game.
It is. We need to move on because I told Wendy we'd talk for Jodi Arias for about 5 minutes, and it's been a little longer than that. So we're going to move on because this is something that that Wendy has been trying to educate the public and trying to get things changed for years, and that is sexual attacks on college campuses, sexual violence. Wendy, let's define that if we can, because it's such a broad thing. What constitutes a sexual attack on a college campus?
Well, that's such a great question because on the one hand, it sounds so simple, doesn't it? Because we know what sexual attacks look like in the real world. Why would it be any different on college campuses? And really, it is different, but not the activity itself. What's different is the law, and here's why. Unlike in the real world, women on college campuses are protected by a civil rights law known as Title IX, or Title IV if it's a public school, but everybody's heard of Title IX. We tend to think of it as that law that gives women the right to equal distribution of sports resources, right? If you're going to have a boys' basketball team, you have to have a girls' basketball team. Title IX and sports equity has been kind of the forced narrative, if you will, on most of us over the past 40 years because it's been around for 40 years. But in fact, Title IX is a federal law promulgated under the Civil Rights Statute that promises equality in education for all people. So Title IX happens to cover gender. Another title covers race and religion and ethnicity and so forth. And the reasons are very simple. When people go to school, unlike in the real world, we want them to be even better protected from hatred.
Mm-hmm.
Walking around
yeah.
in the real world, you know, you don't have special civil rights protections under federal law. But you do in the workplace and you do in school. Well, Title IX, in fact, specifically says that not only are people based on gender entitled to protection against discrimination, Title IX also says that discrimination occurs primarily, in terms of what we're worried about, primarily it occurs to women in the nature of sexual harassment, the most severe version of which is sexual assault. So,
okay.
First things first, sexual assault, if it happens on a college campus, and involves what's called an offensive touching or offensive behavior that is, quote, based on sex, which is to say it could be targeted against you because of your gender, or it happens to you in a way that is sexual, which is to say even men can suffer Title IX violations on campus if what they suffer is a sexual harm. So whether it's a physical contact of a sexual body part or a physical contact that occurs to somebody because of their gender, that is an offense on college. It is an offense in the college environment that falls under the definition of a civil rights or Title IX violation. Now, some Title IX violations are also crimes. So if you're raped on campus, it's not only a Title IX violation, it's also a crime in the real world. They have different elements. You prove them by saying different things, right? Like a rape in the real world is a penetration in a sexual manner without consent and so forth. In an on-campus environment, all you have to prove is that the thing that happened to you was unwanted and it was based on sex. So the same act can be both a violation of Title IX on campus and a rape in the real world, and women and men, if it happens to them, are entitled to pursue both a crime prosecution in the real world and a civil rights hearing on campus.
When you say a civil rights hearing, let's talk about that, because I don't think too many of us, meaning me, knows what that is. So let's say, hypothetically, let's just take two people, and one of them grabs the other one in a sexual manner and says something crude. They're entitled to a Title IX hearing on campus. What is that?
Well, so again, Title IX is a federal law that says anyone in a learning environment, in an education environment, in a college environment, but it also applies to lower schools, not just colleges, anyone to whom you can describe an event, anyone who experiences an event like you just said, which is offensive based on sex, male or female, and let's make it a rape. Let's make it a penetration of the body that was unwanted, okay, male or female. The reason you can pursue justice on campus is because of a federal law there that says everyone on campus is entitled to protection from discrimination and harassment. One form of that is sexual assault, including rape. So
if you have a title.
Suffer, go ahead.
Okay. No, I say it. No. Title IX hearing. What does that do? I mean, is it?
Okay,
I don't understand.
So on campus, a Title IX hearing might look like a rape trial. It might look like a rape trial,
mm-hmm.
right? So you go to you would file your claim with the right person. There would be the dean would have jurisdiction to decide that there should be the hearing that's conducted in the following way. People describe what happened, and somebody or body of people decides whether the event occurred, and if so, what the punishment should be. What's also important is that you can, and some people do, pursue their rights in the real world as well.
Mm-hmm.
They
right.
say, okay, it happened on campus, but it's also a crime, and I don't have to choose between pursuing justice on campus and pursuing justice in the real world. I can and should pursue justice in both places. And the benefits are, in the real world, as you know, because we've seen so many trials together over the years, you have to prove it's the prosecutor's case, and they have to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very tough standard, something like 95% proof. On a college campus, it's not the victim's personal case. It's really the university's responsibility to deal with any kind of targeted harassment, whether it's based on gender or race or ethnicity or anything. It's all the same. It's all treated the same way. The university has a responsibility to respond and to assess the information, and if they find by a preponderance of evidence that the event happened, then they have to take action. So it's a much lower standard of proof. Instead of 90 or 95% proof, which is the criminal standard, it's about 51% proof. And the colleges that I've trained are told that if you have two people and one says this happened and the other says something different happened and you believe one of them just a little bit more than the other, then you have to do something. And I'm not saying everybody has to get expelled. There are some people who feel that way. That's not how I feel. But you have to do something. And the reason is very simple. Nobody who goes to school, you know, should have to worry about being attacked or raped or beaten because of who they are in society. You should be able to
mm-hmm.
have your education and feel, you know, uninhibited and protected. And that's not asking too much. You send your kid off to college, they should at least be safe. And maybe, hey, for $50,000, they might even learn something. That's how, you know, how a lot of my clients feel.
Mm-hmm.
But Tricia, let me say this. This is one thing I want to share with folks, because there are a couple of very important articles at my website. Again, it's wendymurphylaw.com, where, as you know, I not only have a link to my book and the sale of my book. I know you have it up on your site. Thank you so much
mm-hmm.
for that. And I love to get feedback from folks, whether they like it or hate it. I like to get feedback from
Good.
Folks. So thank you for that.
You're
but
welcome.
At my website, I also have a link to a series of articles about some pretty disturbing university-based behaviors. And maybe this won't sound surprising to your listeners. It doesn't surprise a lot of people with whom I work, but some of the worst schools in this country are the ones with the best reputations, because,
mm-hmm.
and I mean worst in terms of how they treat women who've been victimized, in particular women who've been victimized, because they're so much more worried about their reputations that they're that much more eager to sweep things under the rug, and they sweep things under the rug in part by just disrespecting the victim and saying, we don't believe you, or we think it was your fault, or what were you doing drinking? And a lot of these cases, the victims have been drugged, and it isn't really about, you know, she got drunk and wanted to have sex and regretted it the next day. I've never seen cases, I haven't personally had a case like that, but I hear people say, oh, that's what this is really about. No, in a lot of my cases, the victims have been drugged with mm-hmm. stuff that gets whipped up, because you can make virtually any kind of rape drug like GHB and all that stuff. You can make those kinds of things at home with regular
right.
ingredients. And so guys have figured that out. The recipes are on the internet. Victims don't realize. They trust the guy. You know, they end up completely unconscious. They wake up the next day. They're badly injured, and they have very little memory of what happened. And so it's a terrible epidemic. But what I want to tell you is that, and I hope your listeners appreciate the importance of this point, sometimes it's the schools with the, you know, with the ivy all over the place, like Harvard and Princeton and the University of Virginia, that are the least respectful of women, because they're so much more worried about their reputations, and they want the tuition dollars to keep coming in, and they don't want
mm-hmm.
the public scandal. So I'm actually involved in several, well, I've handled these kinds of cases for 20 years, and a couple of the articles at my website go into more detail that for anyone who's interested, especially if your listeners are sending their daughters off or their sons off to college, you know, in a few weeks, please take the time to read what I've written about the Campus Save Act, which is a bunch of nonsense. It's a horrible bill that was forced through Congress by the lobbyists for the elite schools in this country who wanted to pass new laws to make it even easier for them to violate women's rights and to ignore the pleas of rape victims on campus. And it's just a horrific, terrible bill that is all wrapped up in nice language. So, you know, if you're an unwary parent, you might think it's a good thing. It's a terrible thing that's just outright disrespectful of women's bodily integrity and women's need for safety when they're in college. But here's
sure,
the thing to know. So I have several cases pending against. You ready for this one? Let me tick off some names for you. And they're all under a federal investigation right now as I speak. Harvard, Princeton, the University of Virginia. The University of Virginia is in particular hot water. They're all three under the investigation by the Office for Civil Rights. The first two at the Department of Education. The UVA is under investigation at the Office for Civil Rights at HHS, Health and Human Services, because of the alleged actions of a nurse there, a nurse named Catherine Lawn, who handles most of their rape cases on campus, who took photographs of a victim's vaginal injuries. And then at the hearing, when they were supposed to figure out whether this guy who was a repeat offender should be
mm-hmm.
punished for drugging and raping this victim, she said, oh, no, she had no injuries. This is a victim who had her vaginal area swabbed and she was catheterized, and it was covered with dye so that they could take the pictures that show the injuries very well. And
mm-hmm.
the pictures were, dozens of pictures were taken. And when the nurse went to the hearing, number one, she said there were no injuries, which was a lie. Number
mm-hmm.
two, the report of all the photographs, missing. Number
of course.
Three, the actual photographs of the injuries, nowhere
mm-hmm.
to be found. Nowhere to be found.
Now, Wendy, that would be perjury in a court of law. What happens
yep.
on these campus tribunals that try to function as a court? I don't understand it, first of all. I have a couple questions after listening, and I did read your articles on your website, and thank you. They're well written and very
interesting. Thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, absolutely. But what I don't understand for me, and I actually was a victim of rape.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
So be it. Actually, twice, once when I was a child and then once later in life. But the police, I don't understand what's the benefit of going through the college when you just call the police and say, this has happened.
Let me answer that in two quick ways. And first of all, I'm very sorry to hear what happened to you, but in some ways it doesn't surprise me. Most of the literature shows that children who are sexually violated are far more likely to be violated again as adults. And, you know, there are many reasons for that. But, you know, I hope you're doing okay, and I hope you take the time to, you know, get the intervention you need to be able to understand all that, because the bad guys pick on the vulnerable, and that's not an accident, you know, and you clearly were vulnerable, and so I'm so sorry to hear that. But picking, you know, when you say to a victim who's been raped on campus, call the police, you're forgetting that it's an easier case to prove on campus if you just compare the burdens of proof, because it's a preponderance of evidence standard on campus, and it's a beyond a reasonable doubt standard in the real world, number one. Number two, most of the prosecutor's offices that are in the periphery of these schools, whether it's outside Yale or Princeton or Harvard or UVA, they are in bed with the school. So those prosecutors who are elected officials, they don't take these cases on. Some do, but it's the exception. They won't take these cases on because they are political. They are worried about, you know, things other than the well-being of women. And maybe even more importantly, I want schools to do their job. They're required by federal law. If they accept federal monies, there's a quid pro quo. You want the federal government's money, which, by the way, is your money and my money. If you're going to take public money and then run your quote-unquote nonprofit university, you have a responsibility to not only deal swiftly and effectively with reports of any kind of violence on campus, you have a job to do to repair the environment, the climate, the feelings that all women have on campus when they know that rape is happening. If you have a reputation for not dealing responsibly with rape, all the girls on campus are affected, or the boys. And I don't mean to downplay the significance of male victimization. It is far more common than most people will say. But on campus, it is disproportionately male on female. Only 5% of women ever tell, and that's in part because they don't expect anyone to believe them, because college officials make it damn clear, don't bother reporting. It's only going to get awful and ugly. People are going to side up against you. We're going to rake you over the coals. Love you so much. Can you please pay the next tuition bill? That's how it goes. And now families are starting to rise up, as well they should, and they're screaming and yelling, and they're saying the most important thing we can all do as parents of teenagers, and to share with the next generation after that, the most important thing we can do is to say, let's speak with our pocketbooks. Don't send your daughter to Harvard or UVA if what you care about is her well-being and her integrity. If you care about your child's well-being, and if you care about her being respected as a human being, why would you send her to a university with a reputation for downplaying the seriousness of rape, for sweeping rape under the rug? Send your money to the school with a better record. And by the way, I don't mean
now,
a better
has
record.
Has anyone documented which schools are proactive in the case of victims
It's funny you should ask, because I'm in the process. I'm also involved in a lawsuit, by the way, against Yale. I mean, there are so many problems at the Ivies. It's why one of the pieces at my site is called Certain Universities Earn the Label Rape You, because it does matter that the elite schools care more about sweeping things under the rug. So to account for that, I'm actually teaming up with a bunch of parents in some of my cases and some of my former clients. We've developed a website. It isn't yet running, but it's called PUSHER, and it stands for it's PUSSH-ER, and it stands for Parents United with Students Against Sexual Harassment, Especially Rape. And the purpose of our website will be to give parents that basic information. Here's a school
Perfect.
That's doing the right thing. Here's a school that's doing the wrong thing. And what I want every parent to know is, don't judge a school by whether it reports a high or a low number. Every year, schools are required by a different federal law called the Clery Act to report how many incidents happen on campus every year. Some schools say, oh, we had 80 rapes last year, and you think, oh, I'll never send my little darling to that school. Wrong. Because Harvard, one year not too long ago, reported something like 7 or 8 rapes, and that was just a lie.
It was a lot,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know, it's better to send your child to a school that's telling the truth, which could mean that's a higher number, because a school with a higher number is trying to be more honest and open about the problem, and the school with the false lower number is the dangerous school for girls, where you know they're sweeping things under the rug.
Wendy, we have
now,
a question.
Wendy, what about the powerful alumni?
Michael?
I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Yep. Hold on one second. We just have a couple of questions in the chat room, and I think this is really important. The Sandusky trial and Title IX, wouldn't that go hand in hand with the Title IX federal law, Jerry Sandusky abusing those boys on campus?
Yeah, such a great question. There are a couple of problems with Title IX as applied to Jerry Sandusky's case. I thought about it, believe me. In fact, every time I hear about anything with regard to sexual stuff on campuses, the first thing I think about is Title IX. But there are a couple of reasons Title IX wasn't really the right vehicle, frankly, although it's not entirely the wrong one, including that the victims were all not really part of the campus community. Much of his behavior occurred in connection with, but not on campus, and the students and the children were not students, nor was he a student. So his tangential connection mixed together with the, you know, barely connected status of the victims made the Title IX umbrella a little bit weak. I think it was still arguable, but some folks, I think, did file a complaint, and the complaint was not accepted by the federal government. The federal government has discretion whether to accept it or not as a reason to investigate. There also, you know, there were other issues about how Title IX should have worked in terms of the timing. So you can't just file anytime you want. You have to file within 180 days of the incident. And clearly the Sandusky stuff didn't come out until much, much, much later. So I think there were a couple of what I would call procedural problems, but absolutely, in my opinion, if that happened tomorrow, if a child tomorrow was in a locker room at Penn State and Jerry Sandusky, even as a semi-retiree, was the responsible party, I would file under Title IX in a minute, and I would file a criminal complaint, and I would file, so much stuff your head would spin, and there are lots of different places to file when it's a child. You get sort of extra places to file. But I like how whoever asked that question thinks, because nobody thought about Title IX when the Sandusky case broke. Nobody except me, and I kept talking about it, or I would raise it, and people would say, why are you talking about a law that has to do with sports, Wendy? Why are you talking about soccer, girls' soccer? You know, it takes a little bit of extra energy to explain, no, Title IX says nothing about sports. If you read it, it just talks about, you know, anti-harassment, anti-discrimination, anti-violence. Those are the key problems that we want people to think about when we hear the phrases Title IX and you know, discrimination. The first thing you want to do when you hear about anti-discrimination, anti-harassment, is think about harassment and violence, not sports equity. I said to somebody at a conference recently, you know, there are various other titles that apply to various ethnicities, religion, and so forth, and Title IV is one that actually applies to gender and ethnicity and race and religion. I said, can you imagine, but it applies to public schools, where Title IX applies to private schools. So let's say, you know, back when Title IV was first enacted, and we're going back more than 40 years, let's say, you know, they say, okay, we want to make sure there's no harassment and discrimination of Jewish students on campus.
Okay,
terrific. Imagine how the Jewish leadership in this country would have responded if the next thing we did was offered Jews their own hockey team. I mean, it's just such a stupid thing when you think about how Title IX got hijacked. It was meant to be primarily a source of anti-violence. You know, like, let's not harass and beat and rape women. And it turned into a sports equity rule because people kidnapped it. But all the other titles didn't get kidnapped. And we think about those as primarily being about anti-violence and anti-harassment. Yardley Love. Remember the case of Yardley Love? She was brutally killed by George Hughley at the University of Virginia. UVA, the same school that's been in hot water with the federal government for a long time, with the bad nurse who made up stuff in my case. So how did a woman end up beaten to death by her boyfriend in college? I mean, the nature of that kind of violence is also a Title IX issue, because he beat the hell out of her because she was his girlfriend, and he owned her, and he wanted to continue to own her as his girlfriend. And when she refused to stay with him and broke up with him, he killed her. I mean, that's a Title IX problem. No woman should go to college fearing that if she doesn't keep dating a guy, she's going to be dead.
Yes, absolutely right. Michael, you had something that you wanted to say. Go ahead, and then I have another question for Wendy.
Well, this was going, I feel like I'm backtracking now, but
that's okay.
In talking about the Ivy Leagues, you know, we know so many big-name, big-wig graduates and donors, I'm sure, are very influential with the presidents of these colleges and whatnot, and they do want to keep the reputation sterling for their own sake and for other successful alumni. So I do think money talks in those cases, and I think it's just outrageous. Wendy, am I correct in my thinking?
You know, I like how you think, Michael, because not only are you correct, that's a tremendously untapped resource that's been a bit of frustration for me. I first took on Harvard, you know, 15 years ago on this issue, when they decided that any rape victim who came forward was going to have to provide sufficient independent corroboration, or they wouldn't even count her case, much less investigate, much less punish the guy. And of course, that's just so offensive and disgusting and sexist and outrageous. And you would think that the alums would have risen up and said, what the hell country is this, right? Much less a leading university. And they, you know, they really haven't stepped up. And I think it's a double-edged sword. So yes, they are alums, and there are a lot of, you know, there's a lot of money at Harvard that, if they were really free to use it, could change the world overnight on this issue. But they don't feel free to use it, and they don't feel, in my opinion, that this is an important enough issue the way they do around, you know, disinvestment of monies in you know, some far-flung country that is violating human rights. So, and I point that irony out a lot, or the hypocrisy. I say, you all meet at these board of trustee things, and you say, let's not invest our endowment in, you know, somewhere in Africa that's disrespecting women's rights. And I say, hello, how about disinvestment in your own self, you naughty boys? Because Harvard, as it stands right now, Harvard and Princeton are the two worst schools in the country when it comes to applying the correct standard of proof. As I told you, the rule is you have to apply that preponderance of evidence standard. 99% of schools in this country actually comply with Title IX in terms of applying that 51% burden of proof. Mm-hmm. Harvard and Princeton refuse. They just refuse. They're arrogant. They are nasty about it. They don't care. They went to Congress after they got in trouble. They've been under investigation for coming up on 3 years because they persist in refusing to comply. They want to apply a stricter standard.
What's the stricter standard they want to apply?
That they
want
to
percentage?
Apply a stricter, well, somewhere around 75 to 95% proof. But
okay.
That's not allowed under federal law, right? So they've been under investigation in my cases. By the way, the corroboration requirement, let me just back up for 1 second, which they adopted some 15 years ago, and I filed a federal action against them, and it forced them to change their policy. So that was, you know, that was a long time ago. They knew they were offending women as a class by saying the word of a woman isn't good enough at Harvard. You had to have your word plus, you know, some corroboration.
Right.
And they knew that was the kind of stuff that we typically laugh about as coming from some obscure third world country that requires women to come out only on Sundays, right? But that was Harvard's adopted policy.
That's just
and that was only 15 years ago. So they were forced to fix that. So flash ahead now, 3 years ago, I took them on again because they refused to apply the correct preponderance standard, which is about 51% proof, and they were applying instead what's called the clear and convincing evidence standard, about 75% proof. They didn't want to fix their standard. So they're still under investigation after almost 3 years because they continue to refuse to comply. Now, here's an interesting issue. In the past 3 years, rather than just doing what 99% of the schools in this country do and respecting women as true equals and honoring what the federal civil rights law says about Title IX, they went to Congress. These elite schools went to Congress and wrote a law called the Campus Save Act and gave themselves permission to apply the stricter standard. They passed a law. They passed a law that as of early 2014 will give them the authority to apply the stricter standard. Everyone else in the country simply said, no, let's just obey federal law and treat women with respect. Nope, not the elite schools.
No,
they went to Congress. They spent a fortune on lobbyists, got a whole new law passed to make them, to make them look good so they can say, well, see, we're not violating the law. Well, that's because they own the law. That's because they control and make the law.
They
but
made it, right.
Right, but they don't care that 99% of every school, all the schools in this country, 99% thought it was a better idea to just respect women as equals. And the elite schools said, no, we're not going to do that. We're just going to go to Congress and change the law and spend a fortune and get our lobbyists to shove it through. And off it went, right through.
I wonder how many of our congressmen are actually alumni of those Ivy League.
Exactly.
I think that,
you know, Michael, I like how you think again, because you're exactly right. Half of Congress is from Harvard, Yale, Princeton, you know. And the lead senator, the lead guy on this, by the way, Bob Casey, who's in Pennsylvania, has very sadly, in some strange, twisted way, held himself up as a hero of sorts for filing the bill. And I've trashed him in everything I can write about it, saying, you know, he should hang his head in shame. How much did this cost? You know, where do the lobbying dollars go? Why are you saying that you're helping women when this is so destructive and offensive and sexist? You should be embarrassed.
Now,
right,
Wendy, you say this is law now. We're talking with Wendy Murphy.
It doesn't become effective until 2014.
Okay, so that meant that, yeah, okay, but it's been passed, so it will become effective. That means that a president had to sign it, or am I mistaken?
Yes, he did.
So what?
And he did?
What the hell?
Our president signed it?
Yes, he did. Guess what school he went to?
Harvard.
Yeah, right.
Oh, that's
disgusting. I give Obama credit because he's the first president in our history that ever, when he did his, when he gave a statement when he gave a statement about Title IX on its 40th anniversary a couple of years ago, he was the first president ever to say in his declaration that Title IX also covers sexual assault. Every other president just made it about sports. So I give him credit. But, you know, to do that on the one hand and then sign this horrific bill on the other, wow, you know, that's
why
not
didn't
a president
we hear
I
about
need.
This? Why didn't we hear about that? That's just appalling to me.
It really is.
Well, the answer is, and you're going to totally appreciate, both of you will appreciate the simplicity of this point. The reason you haven't heard about it is none of us owns a network.
Well, that's true. I guess our news is controlled. Absolutely. We do have another question here, and I wanted to ask this to you. Wendy. It's from our chat room. How do you go about empowering the students? What do you give to them to make them feel and understand they have the power to do something? I guess it's just sit down and talk to your kids and explain Title IX and what you need to watch out for and explain to them, hey, it's not okay to go around and joke and grab someone's private parts and squeeze and make a joke about it. You can get in big trouble if you do stupid stuff like that.
And of course, also just talking to boys and girls about why it's a wonderful way to be, that we can respect each other and, you know, be kind and loving. And by the way, I also am a big fan of sex, lots of sex. You know, sometimes things happen because people don't have a good sense of how to communicate about sex. And that's difficult for young people. They're just first time away from home. They don't know what they're doing. And they, you know, they can get in trouble out of stupidity. So we need to be more open with our kids about their bodies and sex and that it's okay to have those feelings. And really let some of that stuff out because that's part of the problem. But also know that the value of respect when it comes to how women treat men and how men treat women and how men treat men and vice versa, the notion that respect is not sexy is so wrong. And we really have to work harder to make respect sexy. There are lots of great men's groups out there that have not just bumper stickers but wonderful training programs about how to change the vibe in the room from one where aggression feels exciting and sexy to one where openness and I don't know, candor is erotic.
Tenderness, you know? And respect. Yeah.
Tenderness, yeah. I mean, we don't all have to be Pollyanna, but we have to be on a different pathway than violence and aggression.
Absolutely.
And that's to me something that both males and females can work harder on. The other thing that I teach students, and I lecture a lot on this topic, is just that we have to realize that there is a very basic reality that it isn't always just about sex. It's sometimes about something even more, human. The notion that my right to swing my fist ends before it hits you in the nose, that's a basic concept that applies to all body parts, right? That you can only do what your body wants to do so far. You can only go so far, and then it's not your choice anymore. It really isn't. And then the thing that I think in terms of Title IX and Title IV and empowering students generally is use the internet, man. They are so good on the internet. And bring yourselves together, rally, create your own spaces. Think about places like Pusher. Give your voices. I now have a piece up at my website written by a medical school student who was raped. You know, we think it's just freshmen who get raped, freshman girls who get drunk and get raped. No, as Michael said, it happens to males a lot. And it happens to graduate school students. And it happens, to people that we don't necessarily stereotypically think as the vulnerable. And the offender isn't always the bully. Sometimes we have to just open our minds a little bit and realize that there's more to the story than the one that makes the front pages of the paper. So getting students to tell their stories and to bring them together and to let them be in charge of the information is key. Don't let your school tell you your rights. Go outside of your school to learn your rights. Don't look to the people who seem nice and, the one on campus whose task it is to help you, the student, navigate through your disciplinary and Title IX processes, don't go to her or him. Go to your parents and go to the lawyers that are outside the school, that are independent of the school. Get truly external advice, because once they grab onto you, once the school grabs onto you, they send you down this pathway where much of what they say is, don't make so much of it. We'll help you get over it. But, my experience has been, and I've been in this business for a long time, students on campus, when rape happens, they don't just get over it. And often they leave. Often they quit school. It affects them forever. And we like to think of rape as just bad sex. It isn't. It's far more. Far closer to murder, and I don't mean that. I don't mean to be hyperbolic. Even the United States Supreme Court has said rape is as close as we can get in the law to murder without taking a person's life. It is the most offensive harm to the self, short of homicide, and that's because it is so destructive to take away a person's authority over their intimate self.
The violation, absolutely.
I really like that advice that you gave, Wendy, as far as I would not count exclusively on my school to be proactive on my behalf. It does take seeking external support, be it an attorney such as yourself or police officers or someone. I would keep all pressure on from every angle and not just leave it to the school's mercy.
Yeah,
that just seems like you're asking for trouble.
Yep, and find
one of
sources.
The Ivory.
Yep, especially cool. If you're at an Ivy or the elite schools like a UVA,
yeah.
Get external support and make sure it's people that you trust. That's really
right.
Important. Really important.
Most important thing I've taken from them.
Absolutely. Wendy, I know I've kept you on a lot longer than I promised, but we do have to wrap it up, and but we'll get back to this in just a moment. But I just got to touch on George Zimmerman before we wrap this up.
Sure.
What do you think's going to happen to him? What's going to happen? Is he ever going to have a life? What's going on?
I don't know. I hope so. I think that the beginning of this case and up to and including right now has always felt very uncomfortable for me. And it's not because I don't appreciate that black people in this country have a legitimate beef with the criminal justice system. They do. It's just that this case isn't an example of the problem that they really have.
No.
And you know, to have had the case take on this false narrative and turn into this monster where you really are watching people fight all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that fighting can't be productive, but if you've watched me on Jane at all on this case, I'm the one who just sits there with my hands in my ears saying, please, you know, beam me up, Scotty, because everyone's screaming and screaming, and it's like, oh, my God, you know, that's not even a debate worth having. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about that.
Exactly.
But anyway, you know, I'm not black, and I keep saying I'm not black out loud, even though it's obvious, for a reason, because I don't know what it feels like to be thinking about this case as a black person. And
mm-hmm.
I really want myself to back up a little bit when I hear myself saying, for God's sake, can't you be logical? The answer is maybe not. You know, maybe some people just cannot be logical about this case. So where I hope it goes, the so-called moving forward conversation that is blah, 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 blah. To me, I hope where it goes is that that we can continue to say out loud, George Zimmerman was not a racist.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
the fact that he, and I believe he profiled Trayvon Martin, as would I in the same
right.
circumstance, because if I knew that a lot of people in my neighborhood were committing crimes and they all happened to wear, you know, or let's say they all were wearing orange rain jackets with jeans hanging down and big green sneakers, you're damn right I would profile the next person who showed up in that outfit.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that there isn't racism built into that bias of mine, because the whole nature of who the prior offenders were is itself rooted in some form of racism, I'm sure. But you can't blame people who fear a certain type based on the past experiences that they've had. But you have to talk about it. And that's where I think we've missed the ball on this.
Absolutely.
Instead of saying George Zimmerman is racist, let's take one step back and say, why did George Zimmerman fear that image?
Mm-hmm.
Just talk about that. That's it. And George would say, well, you know, the last 7 out of 10 robbers in my neighborhood wore hoodies and
mm-hmm.
were darting in and out of houses the way he was. Okay, now let's talk more about that and so forth. But I will say that I don't disagree with Stand Your Ground laws. I think it's the most ridiculous thing that people are protesting the Stand Your Ground laws generally, because as an advocate for victimized women and children, I like the idea that you can say to a woman who's in the process, or a guy who's been in the process of being raped, you don't have to sit there and take it.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to try to run, because that's what Stand Your Ground is all about. It's basically saying, we know that sometimes the weaker person can't run and can't fight. Whatever you think of George Zimmerman, my feeling was, you know, the guy is not a very sort of manly, tough guy with the big muscles.
Right.
He's kind of a schlump. And, you know, maybe he was scared. Maybe he was like, oh, I don't know how to fight. Boom, I think I'll shoot. That's
mm-hmm.
terrible. I mean, I really I wrote my latest piece on this, where I said the terrible thing is, and this is, by the way, at patriotledger.com, my new piece on this, and I say this is a situation that should have ended with two men bruised but alive.
Right.
You punch me. I'm pissed off. You're pissed off. You scared me. I scared you. You know, I'm offended. You're offended. Okay, punch, 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 and we go home. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would rather there be no punching at all. But to me, the nature of two guys fighting about disrespecting one another, you know, okay, it lends itself to some aggression. But the point is that because you might end up in a fight with a person with a gun, wouldn't it be nice if we also had a conversation about why it's better not to try to beat the hell out of somebody that you don't like? And I mean this to all the Trayvon Martins in the world, because my son is very interested in the nature of Trayvon Martin's style of dress with the hoodie. You know, my son is not black, but I said, and he's 17, and I said, if you go into a store and somebody follows you around because they think you're dressed like a schmuck because your rear end is hanging out of your pants, what are you going to do if they come up to you and say, we're suspicious of you because of how you're dressed? Even though you're lily white, what are you going to do?
Right.
I said, oh, you know, I could kick his ass. I said, no, bad answer.
Wrong answer.
Yeah, wrong answer, wrong. Kid. Yeah, oh, yeah.
You don't kick somebody's ass because they think you look bad. Mm-hmm. You don't because, among other things, he could have a gun.
Exactly.
Right.
There you go.
So,
absolutely.
To me, the stand your ground law is very good for two reasons. One, it gives women a little bit of equality in the power differential when they're being attacked. Number two, and more importantly, and I'm not saying women should get guns. I don't like guns. A lot of people like guns. I don't care. I mean, it's fine. I understand people like their guns. But what I want the offenders to worry about in this country, the bad guys, the rapists, the killers, the attackers, the thieves, the muggers, the people who pick on the elderly and the disabled, the monsters out there who don't deserve to be walking around free in society, I would like them to start worrying that the next time they pick on the weakling could be armed. I don't want everybody to be armed, but I want the bad guys to worry about it. And that's why I like Stand Your Ground. That's why I will always support Stand Your Ground laws.
Wendy, let's talk about briefly. Go ahead, Michael.
Sorry, I was going to... I thought it was interesting in your piece, Wendy, that you had written about Massachusetts, where they don't have the Stand Your Ground law, and a woman being raped or anything could be held on manslaughter charges or brought up on manslaughter charges if they determined she would have been better off to shoot her attacker in the foot to at least allow herself to escape. And I thought,
That's the law. This is the thing. The law in many states, the states without Stand Your Ground, says this: you can use lethal force in self-defense, even if you only might suffer bodily injury, but you'll be found guilty of manslaughter for using excessive force if you reasonably could have done something less than lethal.
Yeah.
Right. Right, and so that's why you shoot in the foot as an example. That's the problem. Massachusetts, we had a case a couple of years ago about a guy who his truck was parked in the driveway of his house.
Oh, I read this. Yeah,
He had expensive tools, and a robber broke into his truck and was in the process of stealing his tools that he uses for work every day. And the guy went out and punched him in the face, and the police came, and the owner of the tools was arrested.
That's so ridiculous.
I know.
That was the greatest story, and I loved what he said to the police. What was I supposed to do, take to work, if I stood by and waited for the cops to come and he had escaped with my tool?
Exactly.
Right.
Yep.
The
cop said, too bad, you can't hit him. And
that
I don't agree with that. I don't think anybody agrees with that.
That sounds like something that you hear on News of the Weird in another country. I mean, that's just too bizarre. Wendy, tell us again when your article is coming out and where we can read it.
Well, the article I just mentioned, which is about Stand Your Ground laws, is right now, just out this weekend, at patriotledger.com.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an article on the Zimmerman verdict generally and the president's speech being needlessly divisive and ironically divisive. And I was angry in my article. This one is at the Boston Herald, and you can still see it there, bostonherald.com. I was particularly angry at the president's silence on civil rights problems on behalf of women when he didn't say a damn word about the three young girls who were enslaved in chains in a basement in Ariel Castro's home for 10 years.
10 years,
right.
And you're telling me my president couldn't say publicly about that atrocity, this is a human rights violation, those could have been my daughters, this is a civil rights problem? The fact that the president speaks out about one type of human rights problem and not another is so offensive to me. And I write about that at length in the Boston Herald article that came out last week. That's called that's at bostonherald.com. And, you know, I have a couple of others coming out, but just so you guys know, I often will repeat the publication at my website, wendymurphylaw.com.
Oh,
so if it's at one place, it often ends up there. And, you know, I'm still very eager to hear folks' thoughts about my book, which, as you know, has been out for a while, but I'm still selling plenty and excited about it because folks are reading, especially Tricia, you know, I care a lot about the Ramsey case. Every time I do a radio or television interview about what's in my book about why John Benet Ramsey's parents were indicted back in 1999 and why we never heard anything about it until 2013, why that should make us all very angry and we need to rally again. I know she's been dead for a long time, but this is a brand new case, if you ask me, because we just found out only a couple months ago that her parents, in fact, were indicted in her death. They didn't kill her on purpose. She died by accident, but she died by accident at their hands. And the public has a right to know exactly why.
Absolutely. Boy, you got an amen from me, Wendy. That's been my case since day one. That's why I got involved on the Internet and to do true crime with JonBenet Ramsey. Michael, final thoughts, please.
Well, my mouth is ajar. I thought it was the brother that was ultimately responsible for John.
Well,
Bain.
No, we're talking about the indictment of the grand jury indicted the parents, and a book has come out from. Oh my gosh, my mind went blank. His name is James Kohler.
The brother had nothing to do with it.
Kohler is the investigator in the prosecutor's office, and he has written a book. He doesn't come out and say who did it, but he points the finger. He lets the reader decide, and the evidence that he presents comes out to the brother. That's the problem with this case. There was no intruder, but there were three people in the house, and you ask one person, or he asked three people to look at the same evidence, and they'll come up with the same answers. Wendy,
listen. A grand jury heard the evidence. The grand jury voted to indict the parents for child abuse resulting in death.
Yes.
There's absolutely no evidence of the brother's involvement. I don't care what that ex-investigator said. He probably got paid to write a piece of crap to distract attention from the parents. It's very clear to me why the parents were charged. It's very clear to me why that child died, and you know it's related to child porn because the first three search warrants in the case were for child porn. Her vaginal area was a mess, both old and new injuries, which tells you everything you need to know about whether it was an intruder or not. And if the parents were indicted by a grand jury, I think we can stop debating who did it.
Yeah,
I've got to tell you, I know James Kohler, and he's not that way, Wendy. I promise you. He is really an upstanding guy.
I trust the grand jury. I don't care what he is. I trust the grand jury.
He's an upstanding guy who had more evidence after the grand jury. And I'm not saying I don't know. Honest to goodness, all I know, there wasn't an intruder. And it's ridiculous that there's still no justice whatsoever for her. And I know
she died from benzodiazepine overdose. That was the drugs in the pineapple used to sedate her in the making of the business. Benzodiazepines are very common in child porn. They're very, very dangerous. Children get respiratory failure from them all the time. They have no, you know, there's no mystery here. The pineapple was taken, tested. She died with it undigested in her belly, which means she ate it. Why have we not seen the results of the drug tests on the pineapple? What did Kohler say about the pineapple? Tell me about the pineapple. If he doesn't reveal the drug tests on the pineapple, then he's not telling you anything. You know, he's not telling you anything you need to know.
So are you saying?
Wendy, that's fascinating.
I didn't know that. Now, wait. We need to back up here for a second. Where are you getting the information that there were drugs in the pineapple?
I'm saying that it's inferential because the pineapple was on the table, it was in her belly, it was taken and it was tested. The results have never been released. Why not? And if Kohler has the information, tell him to answer your question. What was in the pineapple? It was tested. It was clearly taken and tested. That's not in dispute.
The benzos were found in the autopsy of JonBenet Ramsey, so that is released. Correct.
Is that what you're saying?
No,
I'm not saying
that. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, Wendy, that's what I'm saying. Wendy's not saying that.
No, but the parents were asked at length about benzodiazepines in the home. They were asked at length about the benzos and why they were there and why they had so many, and no one knew and blah, 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 blah. Then we know the pineapple was taken and tested. And if the pineapple was taken and tested, what are the results?
He might have it in the book. I can't remember. I've never made the connection with the pineapple with a drug before. So I don't know.
But that's how she died. She died from respiratory failure, which you know is true because she had shaken impact injuries in her eyes. Clearly they didn't want her to die, but if she had respiratory failure, somebody tried to shake her out of it, which is why she had those perimacular folds in the retina. You try to shake somebody out of it when you think they only are having a seizure, but you can't shake somebody out of a respiratory failure.
Right, exactly. And this is the situation with the Ramsey case, and I would tell everybody to buy Wendy's book because it is absolutely fascinating, and Wendy, you know I think the world of you, and I hope you'll come on again. You always have an open invitation. Anytime you want to come and talk, if you have something coming up, we're here to help you promote it.
Thank you so much. Will you please let me know what Kohler says about the pineapple test?
I will. I will ask James Kohler, and I will get back to you. I promise you. Okay.
Thanks, Wendy.
Thank you, Wendy. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Take care. Bye bye.
Bye bye now.
Bye.
Let's see. Let's do this. Here we go. Okay. Well, Michael, I think we ended that show with a big jaw dropper to the ground. Again, I have my scoop here, ready to scoop my jaw up. I have never heard that she was drugged that way for porn. I take it back. I knew that's what Wendy thought, and I figured it was in the book. But I don't know. I've read the book. I haven't gotten to that part yet. But I don't agree with that at all. I go with Kohler's book mainly because he has information that was after the grand jury.
Yeah,
and,
well, you sure did wait to stress that until Wendy was on.
She's a fighter, that woman. Well, here's the thing. I'd be glad to talk to her on the air about it. It's just I promised her we'd have her on for a little less than an hour, and it's been an hour and a half almost. No, more than an hour and a half. So we can save that for another night. Maybe you know what I should do is have Wendy and James Kohler on together. Now, that would be good.
You're looking for Gunfight at Corral.
I am.
Here on
absolutely.
True crime show. Holy cow.
That's right. It'll be heated. But let me tell you, James Kohler is an upstanding, incredible man, and I think the world of him. And he paid for this book to be published himself. He is not making money, and he had to really suffer to get this book made. And it has the evidence. It has the evidence in it. Now, I would recommend reading Wendy's book, too, because I'm going to go right to that chapter and read it because I'm just like, wow, really? So,
well,
again,
part of what troubled me, Tricia, was the, she talks about the pineapple being in the stomach and she was drugged, but if we don't have findings in an autopsy that JonBenet had benzos
exactly.
in her system, how can we make any kind of leaps about benzos slash respiratory failure slash shaken syndrome? I understand the petechia in the eyes, but it seems like a lot of leaps are being made without the actual facts, and that
exactly
scares me a little bit.
And I was not prepared for that tonight. Otherwise, and if I was prepared for that, I probably would have talked to her first about it, because I find it fascinating. But yeah, you know, it's okay. You can make logical leaps. I've got to go back and see if there's been any medical tests that have been released. I don't remember. It's been so long. But James Culler is a very upstanding guy. Yeah, it's his book is one of the best. Who Kidnapped JonBenet Ramsey, A Foreign Faction, and it's really good. Wendy's book is fantastic as well. Get them both, and you decide. That's the beauty of it. You get to decide. We don't decide for you. You decide. I've got to do a JonBenet Ramsey show here soon, because her birthday is coming up, and she'd be in her, 22, 23, something? It's been so long, I've lost track. Michael, thank you. I know you called in late, and I appreciate you calling in. I know you had some important things going on, so thank you very, very much for calling in. I'll take you late. I'll take you any way I can get you.
Thank you, Trish. Sorry about being late.
Don't apologize. I'm just delighted that you're here. And don't forget, Trish's True Crime Radio is brought to you by www.nokillnetwork.com to find your local no-kill shelter. You could do something as easy as volunteer a half hour a week. They will take any help they can get. Once again, that's www.nokillnetwork.org to find your local animal shelter that is a no-kill shelter. Opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests. And remember, Trisha's True Crime Radio is completely separate, a completely separate entity from websleuths.com, LLC, and forumsforjustice.org. In other words, my darling angels, my darling true crime angels, if you get upset at something you hear on Trisha's True Crime Radio, you don't blame the forums. You come and you talk to me, and we'll make you happy again. It's Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss true crime and current events, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everyone.